All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court. First hearing in our quarterly interim court. Matter before the board, State of Idaho versus Stacy Lee Ingram. Stacy Ingram appeals and is represented by Douglas Steps. State of Idaho is responding today and is represented by Kale Gans. Counselor, I'll give you having a preliminary atmosphere for your own instruction and procedure.
Trust that the court is aware that Ms. Ingram was tried here in Kootenai County on some various charges, including a drug charge and a habitual offender charge. In this particular case that occurred during COVID, the jury was selected in a room out at the fairgrounds. Not in a courtroom. It was not publicized in any way. For the voir dire. And later, after the jury was selected, the trial was conducted in a courtroom where the public was not allowed. Judge advises that the case is going to be shown on a YouTube channel. It was never identified which YouTube channel or how the public might access that channel. But nevertheless,
Mr. Carlson, is your definition of public to the courtroom different than that of Judge Mitchell when he said changed his mind, if you will, reconsidered, allowed certain family members to attend? And I thought the record showed that the judge did open the proceedings to that extent and that there were.
It's not my definition, but the Idaho State Constitution's definition. In Article 1, Section 18, it says, Court of Justice shall be open to every person. It doesn't say that it can be limited by a person's access to the Internet, the availability of them to have equipment, where they might be able to observe what's conducted on the Internet, or to listen to something that occurs on the Internet.
But to Justice Bennett's point, my reading of the record is that Judge Mitchell reconsidered the ruling and would have allowed family members of this defendant to come into the courtroom, that it was physically accessible. Now, the record doesn't show that anybody showed up, but that it was physically accessible.
Well, for a limited number of people, Article 1, Section 18 says every person, not just a limited number or family members, but that every person might be able to observe. Or that in case of the article of the U.S. Supreme Court, the First Amendment says that the press should be able to observe it.
Now, he was excluded from his courtroom that wanted to come.
Well, all we know is that there was limited access, limited availability, and that the only way for the public to observe it would have been on the Internet.
To Chief Justice Bennett's point, that's not what the record says. Judge Mitchell changed his mind the first day of trial. He asks people in the courtroom, raise your hands if you're this group, and he puts out there other members of the public who aren't related to the parties and aren't attorneys. So where in the record does it say he didn't allow members of the general public to attend?
Well, there was nothing in the record that there was any public allowed to attend the voir dire that occurred out at the fairgrounds.
And there's nothing in the record that says the public wasn't permitted to attend the voir dire, and your client didn't object to holding it at the fairgrounds and didn't make any sort of a record to suggest that it was closed to the public. So What do you have in the record that supports your contention that the public wasn't allowed to attend voir dire?
The court failed to conduct the analysis that's required under Waller in closing the court. That's the first thing that has to occur under Waller. It's a four-point analysis that the court has to conduct.
Well, you're referring to the press enterprise test, but that only applies if there's a decision to close. Did the judge order that any of these proceedings close?
Yes.
What is the order in the record that he closed any of the proceedings?
Well, the government relies upon the order related to the COVID as the order that was in place.
So you're talking about our order?
Well,
and you're talking about the Supreme Court's order, right?
Yes, I am. And
have you directly challenged the Supreme Court's order?
Well, I believe we have because there's nothing in the record that would suspend the defendant's constitutional rights or the public's constitutional rights. And this is a fundamental, these are all fundamental constitutional rights required. If the court or anyone can suspend the Constitution based upon a pandemic, then what protections do we really have?
Where in our order, though, did we suspend the Constitution? We just provided an alternate way of access through YouTube or through limited public access to allow for social distancing. Since when would that be the equivalent of suspending the Constitution?
Well, it would be if the court is to interpret Article 118 to require every person to be able to attend.
If you're right about that, that means that if we have a trial in a small county with a capacity of 50 people, and 500 people want to attend that trial, and the judge says, sorry, we only have room for 50, he's been denied a fair trial, is that your argument?
That would be my argument. I think there are alternative means that could occur. There could be, if there were multiple courtrooms, or a line with a video feed into another courtroom, you could accommodate as many people as wanted to attend.
I'm just wondering where this line of case law developed that if everybody in a community wants to see a trial and there's only enough room for certain people in that courtroom, the court is violating the defendant's rights if he only allows what the fire code would allow.
What I'm asking is that this court determine what is meant in Article 1, Section 18 when the authors of the Idaho Constitution use the words every person.
Can you ask that here today where that issue wasn't raised below?
Where it hadn't been raised in the trial court?
Yeah, there's no objection to any of these things. The trial is...
I recognize that. Now, again, it's our position that it's fundamental error under the Nieder case to not have an open and public trial.
And did you assert fundamental error in your opening brief?
In the opening brief, we did cite to Nieder, and Nieder addresses that issue.
But does the word fundamental error appear anywhere in your opening brief?
We did not use the word fundamental error, but we cited to Nieder, which stands for the proposition of a fundamental error. And our position is that that wasn't the only error that occurred in this case, but the court made a determination that the prior trial court amending the charge under 19-26042 to a misdemeanor was not applicable, and therefore found that the prior felony conviction still stood after it had been amended under 19-26042. Effectively denying her, Ms. Ingram, the decision of another trial court that she had been rehabilitated and therefore that should be a misdemeanor charge and not a felony. And then the court went on to find that Idaho Code 19-2514 takes precedent over 19-2604(2).
Why aren't State versus Brandt and State versus Odell controlling on this issue?
Well, because interpreting the statute, the court should apply and give effect to both, ca- both In this case, the court would ignore 19-2604 sub 2 and make a determination that really only the legislature should make.
So are you asking us to overrule Brandt and O'Dell, or are you saying the court didn't properly apply our holding in those cases?
I'm saying the court didn't properly apply the law here and give effect to both statutes.
I'm not sure that answers my question. Are you saying that the court improperly applied O'Dell and Brandt, or are you saying that those cases need to be overturned?
I'm saying those cases should be overturned.
Okay, thank you.
But if the court is going to be making determinations that the legislature has already made, then effectively it's taking the role of the legislature over and interpreting statutes and not giving effect to both statutes, which is our argument in this case, that the court failed to properly apply the law. And most importantly, it denied Ms. Ingram the benefit of the decision by another judge that that prior felony should have been amended, and then went ahead to find her to be a habitual offender, and denying her the benefit of her rehabilitation, and resulting in a mandatory 5-year sentence.
O'Dell is over 70 years old. What's happened in the last 70 years that would cause us to determine that that case was just wrongly decided?
Well, perhaps they failed to argue that the court was not applying legislative intent, and that's the problem that we have cited in our argument.
But do we interpret statutes according to legislative intent or according to the plain language of the statutes?
Well, I think the law requires that the court give effect to both statutes where possible. That's not what happened here. The court just decided, ignore one statute and not give Ms. Ingram the benefit of her rehabilitation, and I'm going to determine that she's a habitual offender.
But my reading of what the court did is it relied on precedent in the form of Brandt to say, Brandt says this is how these two statutes work together. So this is what I'm going to follow the case law of our appellate courts, and I'm going to apply it. So help me understand what is wrong with Brandt or with O'Dell. What's the incorrect reasoning that's manifestly wrong and mandates?
It's the incorrect reasoning is that it allows the court to negate one statute where the legislature has enacted two statutes and give greater value to another statute. The statute should be interpreted to work in tandem to grant benefits of both statutes. And if the legislature intended what the court did in this case, then the legislature should change the law, not the court. That preserves the separation of powers that's set out in having a legislature and having a judicial system. I'm going to ask to preserve my balance of my time unless there's some other questions at this point.
Very well, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Yes?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This court should affirm the judgments of conviction on issues 1 and 3 regarding the COVID-modified trial procedures and the video exhibit. Those claims fail for really a host of procedural reasons, which I'm sure I'll get into, but all of the claims fail on the merits because Ingram fails to show error, much less any reversible error. So starting on the first issue, which is the COVID modifications to the trial, I think it's worth walking through sort of the myriad procedural bars that prevent this court from even getting to the merits. And the first one is this issue is not preserved. So Ms. Ingram never objected below. You can look through the transcript, you can look through the record. It's clear there is no objection to the COVID modifications. And so this is just not preserved. Now, it's true that in the state of Idaho, an appellate can raise a constitutional claim for the first time, even if it's not preserved. But to do so, the appellant would have to argue fundamental error. And I think this court has correctly perceived that fundamental error was not raised in the opening brief. You can control F and you can search for the phrase fundamental error. It's not there. There's no citation to Perry. There's no citation to Miller. And I guess with respect to counsel, I don't even think that fundamental error was argued in the reply brief. And the reason why I say that is because it's not sufficient to simply cite to some other state's application of their fundamental error test. You know, with due respect to the state of Washington, Idaho has its own test for fundamental error, and it's specific. It requires three prongs to be shown, and none of those prongs have been addressed by the appellant, in my view. But even if that claim had been made, even if that fundamental error claim was not forfeited by the appellant, I think it would obviously fail. So I'm going to just walk through those three prongs very quickly. So to show fundamental error, first an appellant must demonstrate the violation of an unwaived constitutional right. Well, there was no violation of a constitutional right here because the asserted case that undergirds the claim is Waller. But Waller is inapplicable because its holding only applies to court closures over the objection of the accused. So that's very important. Waller on its face does not apply unless there was an objection to the closure. There was no objection below, and so the court was not even required to get into that four-factor test. But even if Waller does apply, just assuming it does apply, there was no violation of the standard both on the facts and on the law. So first on the facts, I'm a little surprised that my friend on the other side is maintaining that the public was not allowed at trial. The public was allowed at trial, and it's very clear. We can look at the transcript. Judge Mitchell clearly stated that he would allow members of the public so long as they were in limited number and they were wearing masks. And, you know, not to get too zen here, but just the fact that no one showed up doesn't mean that no one was allowed. You know, you can look at this courtroom right now. It's not exactly brimming with an audience and public support. That doesn't mean that people can't come in if they want to. And actually, there are plenty of citations in the transcript that show that the district court would have allowed the public. Reading through the transcript one more time, I found on page 93, starting on line 24, and your eagle-eyed clerks probably spotted this and you're well aware of it, but just in case they didn't, this is what the district court said after referencing this court's rule. It said on page 93 of the transcript, line 24, if there was somebody that's interested in this trial that just wants to watch the trial as a spectator, for lack of a better word, we can accommodate a few people in this courtroom that are spectators and still socially distance. So it's clear from the record that the court would have allowed members of the public. And if that's not enough, if you go through the rest of the transcript, you can see that the district court actually did allow members of the public to watch the trial because there were several witnesses that, when they were done testifying and they were released from their subpoenas, they said, can we watch the trial? And the court said yes. So if you look at page 125, the witness that was the owner of the lockbox stayed to watch the trial, or at least the district court indicated he could stay and watch the trial. If you look at page 239 through pages 240, Deputy Traw stayed to watch the trial, and he asked the court, can I sit and watch? And the court said, yeah, if the bailiff will allow it. The bailiff allowed it. And then on page 245, Deputy Roach stayed and watched the trial after he was released from his subpoena.
How do you respond to the appellant's argument that if the trial isn't truly open, it means that everybody gets to attend it, even if it's more than the capacity of the courtroom?
Well, Your Honor, I guess maybe two responses, and you kind of hinted at this in your reference to the fire code. I think the first response is the claim that the Constitution requires an unlimited capacity of persons to be seated in a courtroom? And the answer is no. So Waller doesn't mean that there is a hypothetical unlimited number of people that can watch a trial. I don't think that we can fairly read that from Waller. But I guess the more specific answer for this trial is, was anyone actually turned away? And the answer is no. So, you know, it's really just a hypothetical challenge on this record to say that the courtroom was closed because the court wouldn't have let in more people. The court didn't let in anyone only because no one showed up. But we do have Deputy Traw and Deputy Roach. They were members of the public at that point. They were sitting in the courtroom and they were watching the trial. And we also know that in, you know, if adherence to this court's order, the court wouldn't have allowed anyone else to come. They just had to wear a mask, and they just had to be a limited number. So I strongly disagree that the record shows the public was not allowed. I think the record shows just the opposite, that the public was allowed to attend. And I guess just a note on voir dire, counsel says that voir dire was not publicized in any way. Well, we don't know that. We simply don't know from the record. An objection would have cleared that up. You know, when I look at the location, it took place in an exhibition hall. By definition, an exhibition hall is usually something that is open to the public, but I don't know. And the reason I don't know is because there wasn't an objection that was made below. So, the way this typically works is the appellant needs to show the facts in the record that support the claim. So I don't think this court should bend over backwards to hypothesize about what the record could say or what we think it might say. I mean, at the end of the day, it's the appellant's burden to show the facts that prove the claim, and the facts simply aren't here. But even assuming the facts were here, even assuming that there was a closure of the court, and we get to Waller, it's very clear, I think, here that that four-factor test is easily satisfied here. So the first factor is there an overriding interest in health and public safety that justified this court's order and justified the district court imposing a mask limitation and a attendance limitation? And I think, yes, I should hardly need to say it, but the COVID-19 pandemic was just the very sort of overriding interest that would justify those things. Lots of other courts looked at this and have concluded the same. I was unable to find even one court that applied Waller and said there was no overriding interest based on the COVID-19 pandemic. Were the restrictions no broader than necessary? I think they were definitely no broader than necessary. To that point, the court didn't even close the courtroom. It just said, well, we have to have a limitation on people. They have to wear masks. But the court didn't step any more broadly than the public emergency required. And the third factor is, did the court consider reasonable alternatives? Yes, the court did consider reasonable alternatives, and in fact offered one, because it broadcast the proceedings on YouTube. And I'm not sure, I guess, I don't understand the sort of claim that the court did anything wrong by broadcasting it on YouTube. I should go without saying that this particular proceeding was actually more publicly available than any other, you know, run-of-the-mill PCS trial out of Kootenai County. 10 years ago, you would have had to go in person to watch this trial, but this trial was actually broadcast for the world to see. Now, again, the fact that the record shows nobody actually requested the YouTube information to watch the thing doesn't mean that it wasn't accessible. And then the last factor is, did the court place findings on the record to justify the closure? Yes, it did. All of the findings it made referencing this court's order, I think, show that it understood that it was applying this court's rule and doing what it needed to do to have a safe trial.
The requirement of a written order, though, is only required if there's an actual closing. In this case, assuming that there weren't written findings made by Judge Mitchell, did he have any obligation to do so if there was any availability for the public to witness his trial?
I don't think that he did, but if we're assuming that Waller applies in the first place, I'm sort of four or five layers deep into assumptions. If we're assuming there was an objection and we're assuming that Waller applies and we're assuming that there's a closure, I think at that point the court would need to make those findings. But yes, you're right, Your Honor. Because the courtroom wasn't closed, it wasn't required to.
I mean, Waller is essentially the Idaho version of the press enterprise test. And in those cases, they actually do allow for the closing of proceedings, if you follow each of those four factors. And so, for example, if there was a child witness, and you want to protect the child witness from public exposure, court could, in theory, close that aspect of the trial as long as they follow the four factors, right? But in this case, I don't see how it has any resemblance to Waller or press enterprise.
Well, I totally agree with you there. You're right, Your Honor. So the court was certainly not, but in my view, the court wasn't required to comply with any of the Waller factors, including the fourth and last factor, placing it on the record.
And this court's September 2020 order, did that close any proceedings?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe it did. It's an expansive definition of close to say that, well, we're not going to allow unwilling people and we're going to require a face covering. That is that's the same thing as closing the court, I think, is the view of the other side. But I just disagree with that. I think that closing means merely barring the door and not letting people in. But if people are allowed in with a cap on the entrance and a requirement that they wear a mask, that is not a closed courtroom. So, so I totally agree, Your Honor. I don't think the district court was required to place its findings on the record. Nor would it have thought to, if there was no objection and nobody mentioned Waller below, I don't know why the district court would have thought that anyone cared about it. I think the district court would have rightly perceived and did rightly perceive that this court was requiring it to do that. And I think, you know, had counsel piped up and said, oh, I object to what you're doing, we should get as many people as we can in here, right, in the middle of this pandemic, I think the district court would have been, you know, flummoxed and would have just said, no, I've got this order that requires me to do this. And speaking of the order, I think Justice Miller, you're right. The appellant hasn't challenged any part of the order. It's actually not even mentioned in either of the briefs. So I don't see that there is a challenge to this court's order on appeal. But even if the appellant were able to clear all of those hurdles, so those are all the things that are required just to show that there was a constitutional error in the first place. There is no argument on the second prong of fundamental error, which is to say that the appellant has not argued, much less shown, that there was a clear and obvious error. And in order to show that in the state of Idaho, the appellant is required to discuss, you know, whether or not counsel had a tactical reason to decline to object. Now, in my view, there were plenty of tactical reasons to decline to object. So the reason to not object to the purportedly closed courtroom is the fact that, well, it wasn't closed. And the reason not to bring up Waller or not to argue all these factors is because I think they certainly fail. And so, you know, there were lots of tactical reasons not to object, but I think the point for me is that the appellant has not even argued whether or not counsel made a tactical decision.
What about the media's interest or the press's interest? I know there's some standing problems we're going to have to work around, but is it the defendant's responsibility to assert those?
Is it that
if there's some perception, for example, that the press was kept out of this by the way that it was handled?
I don't know that it's the defendant's, you know, I guess maybe this is getting to the standing point. The press certainly has an issue to be, doing their job and reporting on trials, but I don't know that that's the defendant's interest. And certainly the defendant does have an interest in open proceedings. You know, they have their own constitutional rights and their own sort of interests that they're, they can conceivably raise. But again, the overall point is that, those rights were not asserted below and the court wasn't closed in the first place. So, and just moving on to the third prong of fundamental error, the appellant is required to show, and this is under Miller, that there are actual effects on the proceedings by the purported closure. So even if we assume that there was a Waller violation, even if we assume that counsel had no tactical reason not to object, the appellant still needs to show what the effect was on the trial, and I'm struggling to see that there was any effect whatsoever.
Does the third prong of Perry always require that there's a substantial effect, or doesn't Perry recognize that there are some instances where you can't show an effect, but it's still serious enough?
Well, Your Honor, I think you're getting at the structural error doctrine, and so it is true that an appellant could argue structural error, and those are the sorts of errors that sort of defy the court's ability to look back and say how it affected things. But there is no structural error here. I know that the opening briefs made a mention of structural error, but the state has cited to the Weaver decision, and in that decision you have the United States Supreme Court weighing in on this very issue. And they said that in this context, in the context of an asserted public trial rights violation, a structural error is not necessarily a reversible error.
But I guess what I'm saying is the error that's alleged here, assuming it's of constitutional dimension under the Sixth Amendment or under the Idaho Constitution, is not the type of error that is going to affect the outcome. In other words, whether there were people in the courtroom watching, whether it was on YouTube or not watching, it didn't really affect the outcome of the trial. So is that a fair prong of Perry to apply under those circumstances?
I see. I misperceived your softball as a fastball. The sport was a different size. It's hard for me to
understand. I didn't know it was football.
No, I agree. I think that's a fair point to make, to say that, well, whether you have one person in the courtroom watching, whether you have 50, whether you have 100, I don't know what the effect would be, and I certainly, there's no assertion whatsoever that the lack of people in the courtroom, or the asserted lack of people in the courtroom, had anything to do with the trial, had anything to do with the verdict. So I do agree, and now I know the view on the other side would be that, well, this is a constitutional right, we have a right to a public trial, and so therefore we need to perform this analysis, but that's the difference between a fundamental error claim and if the defendant would have objected below. Because the defendant didn't object below, now she has a burden, and part of that burden is to say, no, what was the actual effect? And there was no actual effect that either I can discern or that has been argued today. I guess I'll just make a few noises on issue two. So I don't actually know that that the appellant has challenged Brandon O'Dell meaningfully until this argument today. And so there's no mention of Brandt except in the statement of facts, not in the analysis. There's no mention of O'Dell. And so I think it's a little too late to say, Brandt and O'Dell should be, by the way, overruled. I think it's too late to make that claim for the first time in oral argument. But even if it was appropriate to make that argument now, I don't think the appellant has shown that either Brandt or O'Dell should be overruled. Of course, Brandt was a court of appeals decision, but I don't see that it was unsound in any way. And in terms of overruling O'Dell, there's a test that this court applies, and I don't think that the appellant has met her burden to show any of those factors. I think O'Dell should not be overruled.
One of the things that's on my mind is State versus Winkler that came out in August of 2020, where we examined the effect of a pardon and whether a pardon of a DUI could be used in a subsequent prosecution of a felony DUI. And there we said no. And our holding was, in light of these sources, we conclude that a pardon is intended to spare an individual from punishment for his crime and remove any other effects that his conviction may have carried. And I'm wondering how that standard applies in light of, I'll call it the mercy statute that's in effect here.
So I think, Your Honor, that's a good question. I think a pardon is of such magnitude that the court could have, very reasonably come to that conclusion that if you are pardoned, it really is intended to just remove all consequences from the plea or from the conviction. But what we're looking at here with the reduction to a misdemeanor, it's not removing the fact, there was a conviction, and all that's really changing is, well, the conviction has been deemed to be a misdemeanor, but with respect, I don't know that that's really getting at the issue identified by Brandt, which is, well, if the guilty plea is what triggers the conviction for the persistent violator statute, it doesn't really matter what happens later on to the conviction. So if we deem this conviction from a felony down to a misdemeanor, that doesn't change the fact that that guilty plea preceded that, and there was a guilty plea to a felony. And I guess I didn't set this in the briefing, but happy to supplement with this. I think this court answered a certified question in, I believe it was Gutierrez, which was a firearms case. And I think there's a discussion there talking about the difference between, all of the statutory sort of penalties that are associated with pleading to something, and then sort of the prospective effects that you might have. So. No doubt Ms. Ingraham got a good deal by having this felony be reduced to a misdemeanor, in terms of, professional licensing, that would make a great deal to her. She could honestly say she's not a convicted felon, with respect to this charge, there are other felonies that are in play. But I think the point I would take away from that Gutierrez case is that there are statutory sort of effects that she has to deal with and she's going to have to deal with, and no sort of amount of reduction to a misdemeanor will take that away. And like I said, that's, it didn't cite to that in the briefing because we did not get this deep into the rabbit hole, but I'm happy to supplement with that case.
Mr. Gamble, I have a couple of questions in that regard. So the first is, has the rule of lenity been argued, and if it has, or even if it hasn't, what's the rule of lenity's application in a situation like that?
Your Honor, my friend on the other side can correct me if I'm wrong, but I do not believe the rule of lenity has been argued, and even if it had been, I don't believe that the rule of lenity would apply here, because there hasn't been a sort of predicate argument that the statute is ambiguous. And so,
I understand Mr. Trout's argument to be that there are two separate statutes that speak to the same thing, and they need to be reconciled, and that there hasn't been a clarity as far as the legislature's articulation of this view, which I think is an implication that the one that is more lenient should be applied under the rule of lenity as opposed to the one that isn't as lenient as the other.
Well, maybe I'll let Mr. Phelps speak for himself. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I guess there's sort of two competing claims here being made. The first is that the district court below impermissibly interpreted the statutes. And I think my takeaway from that is that he is arguing that the statutes are plain. And if they were plain, then the rule of lenity wouldn't apply, and we wouldn't even get there in the first place. The other sort of follow-on argument that's being made, though, as I perceive it, is that he's claiming that there was a legislative intention, and sort of the legislative intention was to give the defendant sort of the benefit of that bargain. And so even assuming that that's true, though, I guess I would just point back to that Gutierrez case where this court pointed out that, look, the reduction doesn't mean for all intents and purposes that you will never have any effects whatsoever from this felony guilty plea. And so there might be, you know, statutory repercussions that you have to deal with. And I don't think that the rule of lenity could, for example, overcome, look, if you've registered as a sex offender, we're not going to read the sex offender registry statute in a different way simply because you've later had this felony reduced to a misdemeanor. The rule of lenity can't overcome other statutes and those other statutes' effects on you. So that would be my sort of left-footed response to that.
Well, let me ask you, isn't there a difference between a pardon and reduction from a felony to a misdemeanor, just in terms of legal effect?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor, there's absolutely, and by the way, there would be a difference in this case if, for some reason, Ms. Ingraham's guilty plea was, let's say she moved to withdraw it, and then the guilty plea didn't exist. Right now, we would be looking at things differently. So, but yes, absolutely. A pardon is sort of the ne plus ultra of reduction from the state. I'm struggling to think of what sort of effects might, you know, tag along after the pardon. I don't think there would be any.
And let me ask you, what impact, if any, does the fact after she objected to considering this reduced charge? But then when it goes to the jury, she just says, yes, we have the two felonies. I have the two felonies. Her lawyer just concedes it. Does that have any impact on our analysis here?
Well, I don't want to concede away my own sort of points here. So if this court is leaning that direction, I certainly don't want to dissuade you from that. But, in this context, I think it's probably sufficient for a defense attorney to say, I object for these grounds. The best practice would probably have been at the point that the judgment is coming in to say, I'm maintaining my objection on sort of foundational legal grounds, but I'm not going to sit and fight with you and ask questions in terms of the weight of the evidence coming in. So, So I'm running short on time, but I do want to sort of quickly go through the third issue, which is the video exhibit. So this claim is also unpreserved. There was no objection to the video being played below. The other reason this claim fails is because it asserts an invited error, and this is sort of, this is like a canonical, classical example of an invited error. Defense counsel actually said, I encourage you to watch this video. The video says this, it shows this, you know, you should go watch the video. And so, surprise, surprise, the jury went, and they asked to watch the video. And so, any assertion now on appeal that that was an error is asserting an invited error and should not be entertained by this court. Here, too, again, a claim of fundamental error has been forfeited. It wasn't made in the briefing, but it also falls on the merits. I guess I'm sort of struggling to understand. I don't see what the actual asserted error here even is. If a video is admitted and not published until after the jury is deliberating, I don't see what right is being violated. I don't see that that's a due process issue. We're talking about an admitted exhibit here. And this court's decision in Weigel suggests that publishing exhibits and giving them back to the jury is just perfectly fine. The defendant doesn't argue, much less show, that any decision not to object is not tactical. And, you know, even if we assume that on that third prong there's a structural error argument, I think it's conclusory. Ms. Ingram just says, well, it's deeply unfair to publish this video, but I don't see why. And unless this court has any further questions, I would ask that this court affirm the judgments of conviction. Thank you.
Is it? Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
17 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I'll be brief, and hopefully I'll push time. The trial court in this case did not do any analysis regarding what had been conducting the trial on YouTube. It did no analysis related to the voir dire at the exposition hall. And there's nothing in the record showing the court did any of the analysis that we would argue is required. But here we're not only dealing with First Amendment issue, the Sixth Amendment issue under the federal Constitution, but also the constitutional basis under Article 1, Section 18, and the Article 13. And if you look at Article 13, it says the right to a public trial is for the accused. And that is further amplified in Article 18. It says the justice shall be open to every person. And then lastly, in Article 22 of the Iowa State Constitution, gives the victim the right to attend the proceedings and be there presumably with every other person to actually be in the courtroom. And
is there a victim here that's been deprived of the right to be present at this trial?
Well, the courtroom isn't open. The judge left it up to the bailiff to determine who can come into the courtroom, at least from the record that the court would have before you. There wasn't the court making that decision. He goes, the bailiff could determine if there was room in the courtroom. When he addressed the entry of the officers into the courtroom, it's not the bailiff's decision. It should be open to the public and every person, not just those that have access to the internet or the devices to watch a courtroom on the internet. And the suspending of the Constitution because of a pandemic. As far-reaching effects, it causes a number of problems. The reason that the courtroom is to be open is so that the public has faith and confidence in what's going on in that courtroom, that they can see what's going on, they know what's going on, and they can have faith in our judicial system.
You've used the phrase suspension of the Constitution a couple of times now. I will be honest with you, every time you say that, the hair on the back of my neck stands up.
I appreciate that.
Because that's just a thing that would probably be one of the last things that I ever want to be part of. But in this case, where did the trial court or the Supreme Court in its order suspend the Constitution? It's not like during the Civil War when the president suspended the right of habeas corpus. Nothing to that degree happened here, did it?
Well, I think it did. And I understand. Harry Beckman next stands up and says his mind. And I think many other citizens of the state of Idaho and of this country did have that same experience.
Well, maybe if they were being told that the Constitution was being suspended, but was the Constitution suspended by any of the parties in this case?
Well,
the Illinois court.
Respectfully, Ryan, if the court ordered the ruling that the public could not attend, it would be my argument that the court did. And I mean that entire, I mean no disrespect to anybody on this court. When the public is confronted with what occurred during the COVID, and they see that there are basic constitutional rights that are no longer applied, they lose confidence in the system. And that's why...
Counsel, where in the record does it say the public could not attend voir dire? Where in the record does it say the public could not attend this trial?
Well, what's important here is what is not in the record. And that is, the court did not do any analysis that's required by the closing courtroom.
So hold on. If you could answer my question, please, because you keep asserting that this court and our trial court suspended the Constitution, and your argument in that regard keeps coming back to the public was prevented from attending. So where in the record does it say the public can't attend voir dire or the public can't attend this trial?
The cases that I cited that are from the U.S. Supreme Court set out a series of steps that the court...
Counsel, that's not my question. My question is, where in the record does it say the public cannot attend voir dire or the public cannot attend this trial?
Well, I think I'm attempting to answer that question.
I don't think you are, Mr. Phillips. Where in the record does it say that?
Well, there isn't anywhere where somebody came in and said, I want to be here. But...
And where in the record did the trial court judge say, I'm not allowing the public to attend, or the public can't attend?
Well, the court said there would be limited access to the courtroom.
Well, the court when did the court say that they couldn't watch it on TV?
Well, the court said, in somewhat of an offhanded comment, that he didn't know what channel this was going to be viewed on YouTube, but presumably it was available to the public on YouTube. And that they would be able to see only limited parts of the trial, such as they couldn't see the jury and that sort of thing. And it may have been an offhanded comment, but it was a comment that the court made, and I cited that in our briefing.
Is it not indisputed in the record, undisputed, that this was broadcast on YouTube?
I
watched it or not is the question, but... Is there any question that there was a camera in the courtroom and it was broadcasting?
I didn't see anything in the record other than the judge's comment that it was on some channel on YouTube and he didn't know which channel it was. That's what I recall being in the record. And I didn't hear what channel it was. And maybe I'm not that up on YouTube to know, you know, exactly how one might access that, but I couldn't find anything in the record that told the public where to go, to answer your question. But I did argue, and there was a question about whether or not we argued the rule of lenity in regards to the two statutes. I didn't argue, our argument was that the two statutes are unambiguous. And because there wasn't an ambiguity, the court should have given both statutes effect. Certainly, if it were interpreted to be ambiguous, the rule of lenity would apply. But it's our position that the two statutes together were not ambiguous, and the court just failed to give application to both statutes. Additionally, a question was asked of counsel about what's the difference between a pardon and what occurs in this particular case. I think the obvious answer is that a pardon is something that the executive branch does. The legislature can't do that. Only the executive branch can do a pardon.
All of the Idaho Constitution gives the legislature the absolute authority to control the terms and conditions of granting a pardon.
But it can only happen through the executive branch, I believe. You couldn't get the pardon through the legislative branch. And the legislature set out a similar thing through the going to the court and asking you if you've been rehabilitated to have the charge amended to a misdemeanor. And here, one judge, refused to recognize the action of another judge and give that benefit to the defendant. And it was our contention that the statute was not ambiguous. Certainly, if it is ambiguous, then the rule of lenity would apply. But if the statutes aren't ambiguous, then we don't have to get there. So, I understand that by coming here and making this argument, I'm essentially challenging this panel. These were prior times during COVID, and I think the public has a right to expect that all the constitutional provisions would be upheld, and I don't mean any disrespect to anybody on this court. But I think that is a question before the court. And
how do you respond to the authority cited in the respondent's brief that suggests that many jurisdictions did things equivalent to, if not more severe, than this court's order? For example, in the District of Idaho, we're sitting in one of their courtrooms right now, they had a more restrictive trial order than the Supreme Court of Idaho had. And in the Ninth Circuit, they approved those kind of procedures. So the rule of this district, of this circuit and federal court, would suggest that there were trials happening at this time with far stricter requirements than the Idaho Supreme Court September 2020 order had.
And that may be something that another court might have to determine. Could the Ninth Circuit suspend trials during that period of time and leave people locked up in prison, essentially, if a case gets up to the U.S. Supreme Court on that issue? It's something that may have to be ferreted out by a higher court. And
so if this does go to a higher court, as I asked the last time, because these are courts that we're in today, and this trial took place in such a court as well, that are courts of facts, not courts of talking points. They're courts of facts. So, assuming this doesn't happen in another court, what facts are in the record that will suggest that the right trial was suspended?
I attempted to make the argument before that the failure of the record is the record that the court never made any analysis that's required. I can't create a record that the court didn't make. But certainly I can argue that the court failed to make that record. And then
so we're stuck with the record that we have, right?
All of us are.
And how do you respond to the state's argument that four-factor test from Waller only applies if courtroom is closed over an objection of the defendant?
Well, here's the problem with that argument. That presumes that the public has no rights. That the only person that can assert the right of the public is the defendant. That would deny the public the First Amendment rights were the defendant not to make the objection. So the right is broader than just the right of the defendant. The right is the right of the public and the defendant. And so if the government's argument is correct, the public never has a right to observe a criminal trial. That can't be the law.
Do you think you have standing to raise that argument on behalf of the press?
I do. I think that the defendant has the right to raise that because this concurrent right that issue before the trial court. That doesn't mean that the right doesn't exist. That means, is this court going to say, well, we don't have to look at it because if there's not an objection? How does the public object if it's not, if the defense counsel doesn't make that objection?
We have trials all the time where the media attempts to intervene to open up proceedings. I think that's going on in one part of the city right now.
Well, the problem then is absent a high press interest, there is no First Amendment right of the public. That the right of the public is only asserted when there's high media attention for whatever reason. But the right still is there, whether the media asserts it or not. And that's our argument on the First Amendment. So I appreciate your indulgence, and again, you know, I mean, disrespect by making the argument.
I'll just say this, speaking for myself, I don't bristle at a defendant challenging any order of any court here in front of us. I think the thing that, though, as officers of the court, all of us have to do is to be responsible in the way that we're presenting the arguments so that they're based on the records, that we're not using inflammatory words like, you know, the Constitution has been suspended. I mean, I think that's the issue that I think if my, the hair on the back of my neck bristles, it's when I hear sweeping comments like that to my mind, you know, it's something that you say on the courthouse steps for the media, but not in front of this tribunal, talking about the actual records that we have in front of us, and we're being very careful in terms of deliberating about whether we have, in fact, created an unfair situation for this defendant.
I understand that, and I'm reflecting the comments I hear on the courthouse steps from my fellow lawyers, and I hear from many people in the media, and I hear, if you watch the news, you hear daily on some news media, how is it that a constitution is suspended? And to that extent, I think my argument reflects what's going on in the public. And to the extent that this court can give the public that answer, I think that will assist everyone in helping us through what we're dealing with here. And I appreciate your listening to my argument. Thank you.
Very well, sir. Thank you. Constitution, we appreciate it. Matters under advisement. We're going to take a recess and take a pause.
All rise.